Accession number 23827, Reel 3.
John Street, Reel 3. So carry on with
this. The normal thing was that you flew again in Anson's, and there'd be two navigators, now fully qualified navigators, of course, in the back. And one would navigate the aircraft, but the other one took moonshots or star shots. In fact, I got one here where it's this particular exercise. Every time you took a moonshot for 2 hours, I would take a pinpoint. Then we could compare his position by my position. And that went on for 4 hours 25. So I did 2 hours, he did 2 hours, and then we landed. And then we would do a full trip on your own, again, lasting about 4 hours, where you actually navigated the aircraft all the way around on shots. There are various funny stories told about this, but you asked people being thrown off. It appears that one night we went out, and of course Canada's long in it that way, so you took off from Winnipeg and you either flew that way in a triangle or you flew that way in a triangle. So you could fly that triangle, that's one trip, that triangle, two trips, three trips, four trips. And of course being in the middle of where Winnipeg is, you get different weather on either side. And on this particular night, just before we took off, or sometime, it was changed from going that way, we had to go that way. And I do remember that we went off, and after about an hour's flying, the weather was atrocious. The thunderstorms and electric things, and we turned around and we went back home and landed. And when they counted us in, there was one aircraft missing. Because the range of radios in those days was about 11 miles, I suppose. And they couldn't get this. And then they got to a stage where they thought they were dead. And suddenly, an aircraft was heard coming in. And they'd gone round the wrong way. Now, the pilots were civilians. And all they did was fly. And they knew the place backwards. And they never used to, he knew he was on course, I mean he knew where he was going. But the thing was that these people had gone round that way, but the log had gone round that way, and they cheated. And they were taken off the course, the two of them, and they just vanished. And they were cheated. Now, I do remember that. And
what did you all think about that at the time?
Well, we thought they were horrible people to cheat. A lot of us, you know, I think a lot of us did realise it. We were learning something very important. Not only it was going to save our life, but it was going to save 6 men in the back. And I think to be a good navigator, you've got to be very dedicated to your trade, because you eventually realise that you're more important than the pilot, because pilots are basically just bus drivers. I mean, they just take off and they sit there. Of course, they always get the medals, but, you know, you sometimes think to yourself, well, I'm more important than him, and I do more. But even the gunners are more important than the blooming pilots sometimes. But anyhow, I mean, that's just a side issue. But
so was it quite a difficult course?
It was a bit difficult for some of us, yes.
It stretched you a bit more.
Yes, it did stretch my mathematical ability. If I hadn't been interested in maths, I don't think I'd have got through it, because it was almost spherical trig. Not quite, but it was almost spherical trig, because on the ground you use standard trigonometry, but when you're talking those distances, I mean, when you look at the moon, it's not where you... It's bent, isn't it? I mean, it's all bent. And it was quite hard, and you had to be very quick. You took a shot over 2 minutes, and you had to take 3 shots, so that, because a shot on a heavenly body only gives you a range, a line, and you're somewhere on this line. So you've got to take one shot there, go around 120 degrees, is it? Yeah, 120 degrees, take another shot, go around, so you get a perfect triangle, ideally. Like that. And the size of the triangle, of course, it should be minimal, but it never is, obviously. But if you get a triangle, that when you plot it, it's got a quarter inch size, you know you've done a good job. And it is surprising how accurate you can get. And in fact, when we used to do the Met runs for Northern Ireland later on, we had a sextant fixed.
So quite stretching this course, and you've explained about your doing the triangle.
Sorry?
So did you learn any new things on this course that you hadn't really touched before?
No, we had touched it before, but we never had to rely on it as being our main means of navigation, and we had to use stars. You see, it's quite easy to take a moonshot because it's quite a big thing. It's quite easy to take a sunshot, and it's quite easy to take a pole because the pole star is always the same altitude. So if you put your known altitude on the thing, you can identify it. But when you're starting to look for some of the other stars, Betelgeuse and things like that, you've got to do a bit of star recognition, which I don't think we'd done before. And also, it's finding three stars that are they give you a good triangle. You can, of course, use the planets as well. I mean, normally, in the old days, of course, the old navigator had to be quite a mathematician to work this out on a rolling ship sort of thing. But we did it all by tables. One could go into tables and you would work out the GMT. And we took it over a two-minute cycle because they reckon that the aircraft kind of... and so the minute, you'd use a bubble sextant. We never used we were taught, funnily enough, here to use a sextant, a naval sextant, but we did actually use a bubble sextant in the air. And then you would have to work it out, and you'd have to do this in about 6 minutes. That's quite quick, because we always worked in 6 minute intervals. Because if you do 10 miles in 6 minutes, you know it's quite easy to work how fast you're going per hour, because it's a tenth of a thing.
Did they talk to you at all about how you would be using these particular techniques in action, as it were?
Oh, yes, amongst the people, right from the year dot, sort of thing. Every now and again, you would be, the day's lesson that you were on would be, the afternoon lessons would be cancelled, and you go, and you'd listen to some man who'd actually flown. In fact, the man that writes The Big Peach, he was sent to America, but occasionally he would come up,
Roald Dahl,
and he would lecture mainly to fighter pilots. Rather funny enough, after the war, I was a member of the squadron that he was on, and I did in fact meet him and his actress wife, not his last wife, but the actress wife.
Yeah.
And
what was he like? Because he always seemed a bit
very shy man. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had very difficult to talk to. She was quite easy, but he was very difficult.
And he was a navigator, wasn't he?
No, he was a pilot. He was a fighter pilot. He was injured in the desert, and he eventually found his way across to America, and that's where he learned to write. But occasionally he did come up to lecture to us. And we also had another man that was a very nasty one, that one, because he'd been a bomber pilot in the beginning of the war, and suffered intense burns. And he came across, I don't think, not only to tell us about navigation at war, but I think he always more or less gave you the thing, the knowledge that if you did get hurt, that you had a pretty high class people looking after you, you know. But we did have those people come into a net lecture to us. And of course, they would pick up all pre-war people who flew perhaps in the India in the 30s, they produced these people to talk to you, to make it interesting, I think.
Did it inspire you, or did you learn much of them?
I think it inspired you. I don't think you learned anything, because they were talking about something that you hadn't yet experienced. I mean, all the flights up to now, I mean, I never had anybody chasing me. In fact, I never ever had anybody chasing me. I was very lucky. But it was a very good training, and we were the best trained. We were much better trained than those events with the American. Yeah. They had to do another course when they come back. They learned how not to leave Coke bottles under their bed and things like that, but they never learned. They didn't really learn, I don't think. I don't think so.
Yeah.
And that's my opinion, though. Mm-hmm.
So how long was this navigation?
Oh, it was very short. It only lasted... just through November.
Oh, right.
And I then, of course, changed my O badge to an N badge. The old O to an N, which said navigator. Yeah.
You were quite proud about that.
I, like a lot of them, thought it was disgusting. I had learned an O badge, and an O was more important than an N. And some of them got into trouble quite way up into the 50s. You would see people turning up with O badges. And some of the post-war navigators used to get quite uptight about it. But then the RAF, of course, made an actual rule, a law, that if you flew operationally, or if you were a navigator, you were a navigator. If you were an observer, which they were, some of them had finished flying by the time the rule came in, they were still allowed to wear their O badge. And certain people, army people, if you transferred from the army or the navy into the air force, if you'd gained an observer badge in there, you could allowed to wear the RAF O badge. But I didn't like it, but I never did anything about it. I never ever secretly wore my O badge. I remember I wore my O badge. That was different. I wore my N badge. I used to wear an N badge, yes. And the Americans always used to get very upset. They used to think you were still under training, and you get your full badge later on. But I was very proud to be a navigator. I think it was a much... But then things happened again that I didn't... I don't know why I was chosen, and one of me and a few other people actually. They decided there was a possibility that it might be necessary to have RAF aircraft based in Canada. So a certain lot of us were pulled out of the... again, taken off the ship, more or less. And we were sent on a GR course. Mm-hmm.
Which is what?
General Reconnaissance course.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Again, I went to number one GR school because it was a new thing. And I did a short course.
And where was this school?
This was at Summerside, Prince Edward Island.
What sort of a place was that?
What, the territory?
Yeah.
It's two islands that lay in the Bay of Fundy, adjacent to New Brunswick in Nova Scotia. Mm.
And you were in a Canadian Air Force camp, were you?
No. One GR school was a Canadian Air Force camp.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think it was a joint one because it was new, and this was a general reconnaissance thing. And the navigators went to the one GR school at Summerside, and unknown to us, a number of men who were pilots were sent to the other island to do their GR course. And we were there for a month, half a month. It's a very short course. And we mainly flying, and it was all sea navigation. And you've got to remember, there were very little aids in those days, so it was actually navigating. You used to low fly over the sea, You could work out the direction of the wind, and with a bit of luck, you might be able to work out the. You could work out the speed of the, you could guess the speed of the wind by the wind lanes, and you could work out the direction. And you, we did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 flights. Very little groundwork, just 6 flights in the period of.
And how would they do that? Would it be you and the instructor?
No. We went straight in. The pilot converted onto Hudson's now. I haven't met the pilot yet. No, we had a serviceman who were who'd been taken off the line and made it instructors rather than some were on. There was 5 pilots in the 6 flights, I think. They were all pilot officers except one who was a sergeant. So they obviously hadn't seen any action. They'd been most likely very upset about it, I should think. Or they may have been quite happy. I don't know. They'd been pulled off the thing and been made. All they were doing was flying people like us around. Mm. And we went straight into it. You did no kind of... you were on Anson. You've flown in Anson before. You were briefed and you did a sea patrol... Sea navigation, sea patrol, drifts, 2 hours 25, all day, all navigational trips, and then one what they call radius of action, which was followed by a harbour recce, and the second was another radius of action to a second base. A radius of action was, of course, working out how far you could go before you ran out of petrol, and. They used to say, well, the aircraft would carry 4 hours of petrol, but they say, right, start now, and he'd take his petrol reading, and if you didn't get back in 2 hours, you were considered failed. If it failed, because had it been the true thing, you'd have had no petrol. But having done that, we were then sent off to a Canadian OCU. Now, it was... it was an English OCU that was in Canada. Any number above 30 was English, RAF, and any number below 30 was basically RCAF.
So OCU is what?
Operational Training Unit.
Oh, right.
And now we learnt to fly our aircraft that we were going to war in, the Hudson.
Right. And where was this?
And this was in... we're still there now. I'm in contact with this man. The biggest museum in Canada. I can't remember the name of it.
Whereabouts?
It doesn't matter. I'll tell you in a minute. We learned to fly the Hudson. And, of course, we crewed up. We had our own pilot now.
Right.
And I crewed up with a Scottish ex-policeman, or a policeman from Scotland, named George Souter. And we had 2 New Zealand gunners, air gunners, and wireless operators.
How were you crewed up? Did you choose each other? Or?
We all went to this room, and we all looked around, and you found that the officers would get first pick, and they would pick, because there were quite senior officers, there were some squad leaders, and they would pick up practically their all officer crew, and then they would get down to the rest of us, and you were perhaps drinking, you know, and I would remember I told his pilot, I said, do you like beer? He said, yes. Well, I said, do you want a navigator? So he said, yes. And then he said, well, there's a couple of blokes here, look at their mates. So we went over and said, do you want to fly together? Yeah, well, do you want to fly with us? Yes. And so we made a crew. And of course, I don't know if it was the best thing I ever done. I mean, they were three of the best blokes I've ever known in my life. And, I mean, I think they realised I was good, and I realised they were good, and we were a very good crew. And I've been always very, very lucky in my crews. Very lucky. But anyhow, the funny thing was, is that we said, well, why are we doing an OCU here? I mean, this is unusual. Yeah, this is a... usually Canadians are doing, I mean, obviously the Canadians would, they kind of, why are we doing it? They said, well, most likely going to start a squadron, and you would be the nucleus of squadron So I thought, go, you know, spend the war in Canada now. And anyhow, we did a couple of operations trips, and we were allowed actually to carry these forward at the time, but I can't find anything about this decision.
So you did operational trips?
Two operational trips in Canada I did.
What
we carried, they were sea patrols carrying debt charges. Yeah.
So you were looking for submarines?
Looking for submarines. We were on a definite operational trip. But then, for some unknown reason, they decided they weren't going to go ahead. So they said, right, you'd all have to go off to Trenton. And we went off to Trenton, and we did a couple of trips. The crew did a couple of trips with the possibility of flying an aircraft back to England. Mm-hmm. But they decided that they didn't need us to fly back, and we came back on the ship. And when we got back to England, of course, we discovered that people in England seemed to think we weren't properly trained. So the first thing that happened, they sent us all to a place called Whitley Bay, which was a corrective school, a school for correction. It was the funniest course I've ever been on in life.
Yeah.
It was ran by a man who wore a kilt and an RAF top.
Yeah. Who was he?
He was some bloke that had been in the Boer War, I think, but he was an islander, a Scottish soldier who got into the RAF, and he still wore the kilt.
Yeah. Do you remember his name?
I can't remember his name now. You never got on speaking to him, but I always remember. He talked to us, and he said, I don't know what this place is. He said, I thought it was a borstal. He said, you know about a borstal, wasn't you? He said, but I understand that you have been naughty boys. You just sent you. He said, I'm going to teach you, he said, to fight dirty and to live dangerously. I don't remember that. He said, but back to rules, he said, biggest rule, he said, is you come back from Newcastle, he said, 10 o'clock. He said, that means to say, if you're on the 2 o'clock train, you don't say to me, hello, sir, who's the woman you're with? At this sort of talk, it was so funny. And they were a lovely load of people, but they were the biggest crooks. So I think they were on the corrected. And they used to let the sergeants mess out to various chap people. When the reception, you use the mess. And then you get this be a week, and they say, don't use the mess on Monday. I don't know, I've got wedding reception. And on Monday, I say, free beer. Never went into the RAF. Anyhow, we did a lot of silly things. They were mainly survival sorts of things. Would happen if you got shot down and you'd done a lot of exercises at night, you know, kind of trying to escape the permanent staff. And we learned to canoe in rough water. We scaled up and down the cliffs. Thank God, I don't know why, but we did. He had miles of rope things. He used to walk along these rope things, and of course the biggest thing was the obstacle course, or whatever they called it. And you did this the first day, the first time you did it. You did it in PT kit, and you did it in PT kit, but socks and boots. And you did it in your denims, socks and boots. And then you did it with your denims and your gas mask and your helmet, and then you did it in denims carrying your rifle, and then you did it in denims carrying a VGO. And that was the final course, and they fired real ammunition at you. And there were various stories about the bloke on the course before who didn't keep his bum down when he went over the thing. He got a bullet through the fleshy parts of his abdomen. But I never knew if these were true or not. They were strong rumours. And we had fun. It was fun. I don't know why we enjoyed being tortured, I suppose. It's just one of those things. We enjoyed it. And there was a competition against that we'd get our own back on them. We would. I mean, we were terrorized one day by some corporal, and we grabbed hold of him, and we've been taught how to tie a person up around a lamppost without any string. And you fold his legs underneath him, push him down hard, he can't get up. As long as you've got to be a thin lamppost, so he can't get hold of anything. And we got him down there, and he was there all night. And he was passed by staff. The police knew he was there. But they knew that he'd been put there by somebody for a reason. And when he came back, he came in and he, you know, he said, come on, Corporal. Because we're so free and easy. Come and have a drink. And so he was in the Sinus Mayor, you know. And he said, first time I've been in here, he said, we said, it's cheap, isn't it? I said, you don't have to buy a round. You know, because they didn't buy a round, you know. That's what I think. I told you on the phone I had a good war. And we were there. Then we came back to this OCU, which was 36 OCU, where we picked up our crew. Of course, my crew, I'd already picked them up, so we were all right. But he'd been with me at this corrective course. But the two gunners, wireless operators, gunners, they'd been New Zealanders, had gone to a holding unit down at Brighton or somewhere. Because they were kind of, had to be registered in the country. They had to be told where they could go for their help, the New Zealand, and then we all eventually re-met at this place called 36 OCU, which was just sort of beyond Tees. And this is where we started our real flying over England. We did a couple of nickels and dropping leaflets over the Channel ports. We did what they call submarine swamps. When they would get the Navy would get a message that it was a submarine, we'll say it was last seen halfway between Scotland and Norway, they'd pinpoint it. They'd send as many aircraft out there as they could, anything, as long as it had wings and could fly it, they would send it out there. And all you did was cruised around doing a square search around an area. And all you had to do, all they were able to do, was keep them down. Because if you kept them down, A, they could die because the submarine's batteries weren't so efficient as they are nowadays. And they just wanted a bit of gas. You'd have a dead crew. B, of course, it's more dangerous down there because there are wrecks down there they could hit. According to how low they are, they can't charge their batteries when they're down there. They get demoralized, and of course when they do eventually come up, they make mistakes, so that sort of thing. So it was considered a good thing to keep them down. Then you would go on a swamp. We weren't allowed. Funny enough, we weren't allowed to count these as an operational trips, but we did one at night. I got you. And sometimes they'd allow you perhaps if you did an early morning a daylight one, when you finished the swamp, they would allow you to come back and drop your bombs, your depth charges, on one of the targets to give you some experience in dropping things. But that was 30 number one OCU, number one bracket C. Which means climatization OTU, Operation Training Unit, at Thornaby-on-Tees. And I was there again for about a month.
Right, okay. I'll stop you there. John Street, end of reel 3. John Street.